Hello, everybody. Welcome. Thanks for joining us today. Appreciate you being here. My name is Mike Gibb. I run accountsrecovery.net, and I'm excited to be moderating today's webinar on a guide to how states are regulating debt collection in the time of coronavirus, part two. As the coronavirus pandemic continues to rage, or not rage, but continues throughout the United States, a number of states have enacted laws and regulations aimed at providing economic relief to individuals. We talked about it about a month ago. We're here today to do an update on where we are and how things are moving forward and progressing and changing. So we have a panel of leading compliance experts from across the country to walk through what the states have done and to provide a clearer picture of what is and what is not allowed today. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Mike Gibb. I run accountsrecovery.net, which is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts and even a Slack channel for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope everybody is spending time every day checking out what it's got to offer. Now, let's get to the people you are here to listen and watch today, the speakers. Let me tell you a little bit about them. John Bedard is a nationally recognized authority on the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act and the Fair Credit Reporting Act. He serves as counsel to several professional trade associations, including the Georgia Collectors Association. He's a former board member of the board of directors for the industry's leading professional trade organization, ACA International. He serves as the State of Georgia Compliance Chairperson for ACA International and is a former chairperson and program designation award recipient of ACA International's Members Attorney Program. Stephanie Jackman is the leader of Ballard Spahr's debt collection team and a partner located in its Atlanta office. She's nationally recognized for her expertise in collections, compliance, and litigation across all segments of the financial services industry, including traditional financial products, fintech, and online lending, healthcare, and student lending. Michael Clutho is a shareholder with the Minneapolis law firm of Bassford Remily. A significant part of his practice involves the defense of collection attorneys and collection agencies facing FDCPA, FCRA, and TCPA lawsuits. He's defended thousands of consumer lawsuits brought against collection professionals. His practice in this area also includes the defense of claims brought by governmental regulators overseeing entities involved in the credit collection industry and risk management audits and advice. He chairs the firm's consumer law defense practice group and presents frequently on the FDCPA, FCRA, TCPA, and related issues, and is a certified instructor through ACA International. Don Maurice is a partner at Maurice Wutcher, representing the financial services industry in compliance matters, trials, and appeals of individual and class actions. He is a regent of the American College of Consumer Financial Services Lawyers and serves on the governing committee of the Conference on Consumer Finance Law. He formerly chaired the Debt Collection Practices and Bankruptcy Subcommittees of the American Bar Association and serves as outside counsel to Receivables Management Association International, the trade association for debt purchasers. He's admitted to the bars of Massachusetts, New York, New Jersey, and the District of Columbia. Manny Neuberger leads the Consumer Financial Services Law Practice at Barron & Neuberger. He's known nationally for his expertise in consumer and commercial law, defending consumer litigation and regulatory matters across the country, and providing compliance advice and training across the globe. He's taught consumer protection law at the University of Texas Law School since 1999, and he is the author of books and articles covering a variety of consumer financial services laws. So that's a veritable who's who of the industry with us today, so I hope you take advantage. The format for today's webinar is going to be a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions, and we'll get to them as the discussion is ongoing. To submit a question, please either enter it into the Q&A tab on your Zoom webinar control panel or send it through the chat module. This event is being recorded, and a recording will be made available in the coming days on the accountsrecovery.net webinar recordings page. Finally, before we launch into our discussion, to make sure nobody gets in any trouble, let me read the following disclaimer. This presentation is not intended to be legal advice and may not be used as legal advice. Legal advice must be tailored to the specific circumstances of each case. Every effort has been made to ensure this information is up to date. It is not intended to be a full and exhaustive explanation of the law in any area and should never be used to replace the advice of your own legal counsel. With that, I can pass the baton over to our panel and the people you are here to hear from. It's difficult to say today. First, let's talk about the state that's maybe been the flashpoint for debt collection regulation in coronavirus, and that's Massachusetts. Don, why don't you kick us off by giving us an update on where we are there?
Thank you, Michael, and thanks for having me back. It's great to be here with all of my friends. So, Massachusetts, there's been a lot going on, and there has been for some time. This is not something new in Massachusetts. RMAI has been fighting legislation in Massachusetts for over 5 years. But with the COVID-19, the legislation and regulation has increased and intensified. And as to the regulation, I'll let others speak to that, the former regulation. But that doesn't mean it's the end of all legislation in Massachusetts. So we have still a couple things out there, some that have become law and others that are proposed. And I'm only going to talk about the COVID-19 because when you get to the People's Republic of Massachusetts, there's plenty of things to talk about. But we have the House Bill 4647, and we have an eviction foreclosure stay that is now effective during COVID-19 emergency, which is a federal or state emergency declared. And it applies not only to residential, but also to qualified small businesses. So it has a pretty broad stroke there of protections. And there is also in the House 5027. And this is an interesting one because if this were to pass, if you sought to collect a credit card debt in Massachusetts, it would be per se unconscionable to do so. And it would continue during the state of emergency in 90 days. Now, this unconscionability, which is a concept that we have in general UDAP and the FDCPA, is very important in Massachusetts because of Massachusetts Consumer Protection Statute 93A, which would be triggered. I think that is the intent here, and if this were to become to law and you sent a letter to a consumer on a credit card debt, but that is not all. There is always more in Massachusetts, and this is the one I think that we should all be concerned about, and it is a 5014. James Murphy, who is a powerful legislator in Massachusetts, is a sponsor, and many have signed on to this bill. It would protect not only consumers, but also these qualified small businesses, usually employ 50 persons or less. It would prohibit lawsuits, and it would prohibit calls during the emergency plus 90 days. And for those that garnished wages or accounts or other types of properties after March 10 20 of this year, you're going to have to return it. So that bill, I think, is the one that, if you were asked me of the between this 5027 and the one I just discussed from Chairman Murphy, this one, I think, has the ability to become something that is quite troublesome. And after the AG's regulation, which we talked about in the last webinar, was sent to an early grave, this would probably not be as restrictive as what the Massachusetts AG proposed, but I think would have just a serious effect. You could still send a writing, but you can't make calls and you can't file lawsuits if it were to pass. So this is only proposed now. It's not the law.
Hey, Don. With respect to the prohibition on lawsuits, do you think that will pass muster? I mean, is there any state that can pass a law that says you cannot file a lawsuit? Will that work?
Well, the legislature in Massachusetts does something which I think is very interesting here, which wasn't present in the Massachusetts AG's regulations, and that is they have tolling built into it. So if you have a claim, and that claim, you could argue, look, you're taking property away from me because I can't sue after this limitation period expired. That concern is obviated with the tolling provision in the statute. But I think that the same concerns over property are here still, because the fact that they're preserving your right doesn't mean that they're not taking something away when they prohibit you access to the courts. And particularly, you know, what's the difference between a debt collector and any other person who is trying, or creditor and any other person who's trying to have access to the courts? Usually it has been fundamental access to the courts. But again, many see it not so fundamental in the context of debt collection. So it's a tough place to be, Massachusetts, for this type of for this type of work, debt collection. We saw that with the AG. We see it with all the other legislation. But I'd be interested to see how that would work out. I'm not about to say that they would do away with it, the courts, either federal or state.
And John, for whatever it's worth, beyond the petition clause of the First Amendment, which I always like to remind people, Judge Cudahy of the Seventh Circuit said is fundamental to our Republican form of government. We've got state constitutional issues. And for those who haven't looked at it, if you're facing one of these laws, you should always look at the state constitution, because an awful lot of them have provisions akin to the First Amendment's petition clause, guaranteeing the right to petition the government for redress of grievances. And I think one of the things I've observed is when we see these fights, people forget to look at state constitutional law, looking first to the federal constitution, when in fact state constitutions can sometimes have more powerful provisions.
That's a great point, Penny.
Yep. Go ahead, Don.
So I don't think we're done in Massachusetts. You know, it's a daily event there. The legislative session has not closed yet. Has anyone heard anything, because I haven't, about what the Massachusetts AG intends to do? I'll just point out that her regulation was temporary and would probably, I think it was 90 days, so it would be expiring next month anyway. But I haven't heard anything, not a peep, from our friend Ms. Healy in the Commonwealth. Has anyone else?
No.
I'm also licensed in, up there and litigate with that office, Don. I haven't heard anything, but the reality was if they wanted to extend it, they were going to have to take action administratively to to have some sort of public hearing. And I think realistically, she wasn't going to get an appeal completed before the temporary regs expired. But the question I'd throw at you, Don, I'm kind of curious what you think, is even with the regs having been suspended, how aggressively do you think the Consumer Protection Division in Massachusetts is likely to go after any agency or other debt collector generating complaints during this period?
Very likely.
Yeah. And that's exactly, Manny, what we've been telling clients is, you know, oh, that means we can call. That means we can call. These restrictions don't apply. I said, well, yes, but to the extent you generate a complaint in Massachusetts, you can expect to have to answer for it. And so you move forward in Massachusetts at the risk of very, very close by regulators.
Well, and I will tell you, I find their consumer protection attorneys to be some of the most professionally courteous enforcement attorneys with whom I deal. But anyone who thinks that they're not going to be thorough or don't understand what to look for would be very much mistaken.
Good points, Jim. Good points. So, Mike, where do you want to travel next in a virtual presentation?
Well, I wanted to spend a minute. John had raised a point earlier. What happened in Massachusetts with the regulation and the ensuing lawsuit and temporary restraining order, John had some thoughts about that reasoning applying to other states. So I wanted to give him a chance to share that before we move down the Atlantic seaboard to our state, New Jersey, Don.
So, you know, one of the things that we should all be quite concerned about is government overreach, right? We have elected officials and some who are not elected who have authority to make some rules, and they are promulgating rules. They are making laws that do not always comport with our fundamental rights. And so I do think that the reasoning and some of the rationale, the First Amendment arguments that were made in Massachusetts can apply in many other places around the country. You know, DC is one of those places in which I think maybe those principles of law are implicated. Nevada, there are places around the country in which, albeit perhaps well-intentioned, by officials who take their jobs very seriously and want to do the right thing, what they are often neglecting is some very close consideration of our fundamental rights and what the rules really are with respect to the limitations that constitutional principles put on their powers. A more recent example of this has happened in the state of Wisconsin, where an unelected official, the secretary in the Department of Health Services, issued an order, and that order was very, very onerous. It was a shelter-in-place order that limited, with very limited exceptions. It prohibited all travel with very limited exceptions. It prohibited public and private gatherings. It closed, basically. It ceased all business activity for nonprofit and profit corporations. It had a whole laundry list of very, very onerous shelter-in-place requirements. And this was an order issued by the Secretary of Health Services. Not only were these provisions in this order very onerous, but they were also punishable by 30 days in jail. Or a $250 fine, or up to $250 fine. Now, the state of Wisconsin has an entire process for emergency rulemaking, but the secretary did not follow that process. Instead, the secretary just issued the order. And so the legislature of the state of Wisconsin sued the secretary, and this case ends up in the Supreme Court of Wisconsin. And the Supreme Court found, look, this was a rule that was supposed to go through our emergency rulemaking process. Secretary, you did not go through the proper process to issue this order, and therefore this order is not enforceable. And so the Supreme Court found that it has to go through the emergency rulemaking process, which the legislature created. And because it didn't, the order is basically stricken. It's unlawful. The secretary did not have the authority to do that, to issue that order. And now if the secretary wants to issue it again, she has to go through the process. And I think this is a really good example, Mike, of government overreach. Here we have a completely onerous order, punishable by 30 days in jail. If you leave your home for a reason that is not identified in this order, you are subject to criminal liability. To the extent those kind of rules are made by unelected officials who do not go through the proper process to create those rules, it really does have a significant impact on what we all call our fundamental rights. And it is our obligation to challenge those things. And so I do think that same application applies in many places around the country. And it is our duty to challenge those. And people who are in charge of making the laws really need to take heed and think about, you know, whether or not they are doing more harm than good in the name of benevolent health and safety when they ignore fundamental rights that are guaranteed by our federal constitution and by our state constitutions. It's very, very disturbing. I'll get off my soapbox here. I get very upset about government overreach, and we have a solemn responsibility to challenge it wherever we see it.
So John, as an officer of the court, how do you feel about the idea of moving to hold one of these executive branch officials in contempt for interfering with existing court orders and garnishments?
Let's see. Oh, I like that. So we have a current garnishment order, and then we have a government official who is attempting to interfere with a garnishment order is the theory, right?
Yeah. The one saying you have to give the money back, you can't honor them, you can't carry them out.
Right.
But the order is already issued. How do you feel about asking to hold those guys in contempt of court?
It seems a lot less
expensive than filing a lawsuit.
Haven't done that. Do you know anybody who has?
No, but we're talking about it.
Yeah. I like it. I love it. You know, because we cannot allow the government overreach like this. And whether or not it's a direct action for a TRO an injunction, or whether or not it's a contempt order like that, either way, we need the judiciary responding to the people's pleas not to be rolled over by these, you know, officials who have, who do have a lot of power and a lot of authority to make the rules, but nonetheless, who don't always respect the rules that govern them.
I'll jump back in here. Michael, Stephanie, we haven't heard from either one of you yet, so I'm going to bring you in. We've got a question here from the audience that I'll ask and use it as a reminder to our audience. If you have a question for our panel, please send it in to the Q&A or through the chat module. But the question that's come in is, would anybody like to predict what states will do more permanently related to the ability of debt collectors to have work-at-home staff from a licensing or regulatory perspective? Let's get out the crystal balls.
I'm happy to jump in there, Mike. Minnesota has a prohibition on doing it, but they did issue an order that said they would do a no action, and they basically have allowed collectors for quite some time now to collect from home. What's happened most recently is that it's been extended through at least August 30th. The nice thing about that is it's been basically an experiment in process where the regulator has seen that folks can collect from home, and they can collect without causing problems, any unusual problems that don't ordinarily happen anyway, because we're all human. And so as a result of that, we feel like we've made some real headway with the department, and the department is working with us as far as this experiment goes. And I believe that I think I mentioned the last go around, even before the COVID pandemic came up, we had been working with the department on this very issue. And so we are now both working cooperatively to see how this is going forward. And the fact that they've extended it now through at least August 30th is, we think, boding well for permanent enactment of that in Minnesota.
Yeah, but to add to that, Michael, and I agree with you. By the way, everyone, I apologize. My computer keeps kicking me off video. So to the extent you're on video and I come and go, I'm sorry. It must not like what I say or think. But we saw Idaho also give an extension last week. If I recall, they conveyed an expectation, I think it was by the end of September, that people would be back in the offices as opposed to working remotely. And I thought that was interesting too. Like many in the industry and many of your clients as well, they're very hopeful that we'll be able to maintain this more remote environment, working from home, getting some traction and making that more permanent. I know that a number of the industry trade groups are working on, there's task groups, there's working groups, there's regular conversation with different regulators about what an acceptable working from home environment might look like, the related controls, how things are happening. But one thing I want to flag, and I'd love to get other people's thoughts on this, because candidly, I'm hoping I'm wrong, but we had thinking about working from home, and as part of that process, and with the proposals that I'm seeing that these different industry trade groups are working on and sharing with regulators and trying to get traction for, they all seem to contemplate that the company will provide the equipment that's necessary, and there'll be all sorts of security controls and other things around it. But you know, employees will receive, for instance, cell phones that the employer provides, purchases, pays for, and that are for work purposes only. So I had one of our colleagues in the industry ask me the other day, if we want to start sending our employees messages on these cell phones that we have provided to them that they are using to make calls from home and for work purposes only, and these would be work-related messages, updates, office reopening, different things like that, are they subject to the TCPA? And of course, my initial thought was, they can't be. That's just silly. But upon researching it, I'm not so sure. And it's got me thinking that to the extent that could be something that any of you contemplate building in or possibly already doing now, we don't want to lose track of that statute and should be thinking about the extent to which we might want to take some steps to protect ourselves, because I'm not coming up with a case that definitively tells me that those types of communications would not be subject to the TCPA. and it's actually front of mind. So I'd open the thought up. I got a lot of smart guys on this call with me who do this work. Gentlemen, am I missing something here? Is this something we don't have to worry about? I know, you know, Reyes and Medley versus Dish in the 11th Circuit are useful on perhaps we can have this consent be conditioned, that as consideration providing this equipment as part of your employment, you agree you won't revoke the consent. And if you do, you have to give it back and provide your own stuff, blah, 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 blah. I get that. But those cases are only applicable as far as being binding within the 2nd and 11th Circuit. And we've seen even within the 2nd Circuit courts try to avoid Reyes. So I was really hoping I would come up with a convincing, solid argument that the TCPA just doesn't apply. But it's not happening for a 47 USC 227B claim. Anybody got any thoughts?
My first thought is this, is I would not recommend any agency communicating in any way with employees at home through cell phones. Our daughter is a collector and she works from home now, but she's doing it all through the computer, through the cloud, working off of the infrastructure that already exists as if she's at the office. And I think it is incredibly dangerous to have cell phones becoming involved in the collection business. So I would just nip that in the bud, apart from the TCPA issue.
Yeah, I have to agree with that. I can't conceive of wanting to give employees cell phones. There's no reason. They can use their computers at home as VoIP extensions. They can make their calls through the computers, which is usually necessary to maintain all of the controls and call recording and everything else. So why in the world are we giving them cell phones? You know, we could have pop-up systems and email. It's all work-related. Why do we need to give them cell phones? There's a whole lot of bad stuff that can happen from that, not a whole lot of good.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. And for anybody who's listening and contemplating that, you know, I can't speak to why this topic came up or what this particular entity is thinking about. But, you know, thank you for confirming I'm not crazy, because we've been looking at it pretty hard, and it was an answer that I think intuitively I felt like it should be different, but the reality is under the existing law, it's not.
Well, nobody uses a dialer to do any of that anyway, right? The dialers are the thing of the past, so you don't really have to worry about that too much.
Hey, maybe the TCPA will be unconstitutional in a couple of months. We can look forward to that too after the Barr decision.
And the moment,
anyway, I just thought I'd flag it.
The moment that decision comes down, every one of our phones is going to light up like a Christmas tree. Because there'll be no way to stop phone calls to our phones if that happens.
A couple of questions.
I'm looking forward to reading that headline.
Food for thought as people migrate and perhaps remain in this remote environment. Just some questions that came up that people are thinking about. And you know, Michael, I think you raised some really good points, and so do you, Manny, and on that. Is this a technology we really want to use in this way, and why?
It's so easy today, Stephanie, to actually extend our office telephony infrastructure to our homes, that changing that infrastructure to a cell phone infrastructure seems to be more trouble than it's worth for all of the reasons you just identified.
We had a list of states we were going to talk about, but we've got a couple of questions that have come in on states that aren't on our list. So I wanted to tackle those first. And the first one is North Carolina. The question is, do you think the payment deferment regulation in North Carolina will be lifted today? Has anybody heard anything about that?
I saw that question come through, so I went to the North Carolina DOI website. I didn't see anything. The last order extended it through today, so I would check to see if North Carolina has itself lifted its state of emergency, but I would be cautious and go back to the DOI website by the end of the day to see if we see another extension order come in, because it has already been extended once. But I haven't seen anything.
Excellent. Okay. The other question was about Kentucky. Has anybody heard anything about collection activity or any news about collection activity in Kentucky?
That is a new one for me. I haven't heard anything COVID related. I will going to try to see if there's anything I have on Kentucky. In Kentucky, I have business closures was the last thing I heard. We have some business closures that until the state of emergency is rescinded. So that was the last thing I heard about Kentucky.
That's the same I have. I was looking at my Kentucky. There was a Governor Beshear on May 8th put out an order to talk about starting to reopen the economy beginning May 18th. So that just passed. They were originally saying that businesses opening on the 18th could operate at 33% capacity and then move to 50%. By June 22nd, if they meet certain guidelines. My understanding is Kentucky that could include a number of our listeners. So it appears slowly but surely you're able to start going back into the office, but I haven't heard anything specific out of Kentucky beyond that.
The commissioner of the Department of Financial Institutions issued some guidance, but it was all primarily related to workplace safety and exercising good judgment. How you had people working in the workplace. It wasn't really collection specific.
Okay. Thank you for that update. Before we get to my neck of the woods and Don's neck of the woods in New Jersey and New York, I wanted to talk a little bit about some states we're seeing, like Texas and Iowa, that are starting to lift some of the moratoriums they had on different proceedings, such as evictions, foreclosures, certain debt collection activities. Does the panel think that this is where sort of all states are heading, maybe sooner rather than later, or is this going to be sort of still going to be like a hit and miss, where some states aren't going to be as quick as others to make these decisions and make these moves?
Who wants to lead off? I've been leading, so unless you want me to lead.
No, I don't know what the decision-making process is when these people who are in charge decide to open states like this. I suspect that it's somehow related to the rate of infection, the rate of testing, the rate of impact that COVID is having on a state. I don't know that to be the case at all. I suspect that if a bunch of smart people got in a room to decide when and how to begin to open up a state, they would consider this, the impact of COVID on their populations. And so I would expect states to be opening at different rates based upon the severity of the impact that COVID is still having on the populations of those states. That is all sort of speculation. I have no idea how they do it. You know, I'm here in Georgia, and Georgia is very, very wide open when it comes to getting back to business as usual. We still do have shelter in place orders that have limited restrictions right now. People at risk are still, required, encouraged to stay home, but businesses are now opening. And I got to tell you, the business community here in Georgia, notwithstanding how you feel about whether or not it was the right decision for the state to open, the business community is responding in a dramatic way to accommodate people's fears about contraction. I'm not going to restaurants yet. Our family is sort of still trying to sort of shelter in place. But there are many, many restaurants that you can frequent now here in Georgia. And, you know, there are half as many tables in the lobby. You can go out onto the patio. There are half as many tables in the patio. All service personnel are wearing masks. There's a lot of that happening here in Georgia. And Stephanie, you can speak to that as well. You're here in Georgia. On the flip side, I will say that, there aren't many places that you can go here in Georgia where you look around and it's as if there's no pandemic going on at all. You wouldn't really know, because people aren't, they're not behaving as if there's any pandemic happening. And so, it's kind of a balance. I know the governor here in Georgia's has a nice website that you can go to that has some data on it, that has the rates of infection by county, the rates of infection around the state, things like that. And I suspect that the rate at which states open hopefully is related in some way to the diminishing impact COVID's having on their populations.
I could tell you here in the New York metropolitan area and the Northeast, it's behaving a different way. It's not state, it's county. So for example, in New York, I get a call from the New York State courts multiple times a day telling me which courts are open and closed, and most of them have been closed. But they are starting to open a few courts in the most, in areas, Mike, where I really didn't think they were going to open. So Westchester County, which really was the worst place affected on the Northeast at one point, will be reopening soon. Parts of the courts in Long Island, Nassau, Suffolk, will be reopening. But of course, Manhattan, Kings County, the New York City, Richmond, the Queens, they're not going to open. New Jersey, and by the way, when they're opening, it's not necessarily opening for debt collection either. They're starting to segment the types of work that can be done by lawyers in the court. So they may reopen for criminal hearings. They may reopen for certain hearings that don't include the public. Bankruptcy courts have also been doing this as well, that they have been limiting the types of hearings. And we're going to see that, I think, in the larger affected states, particularly here in the Northeast, Illinois, I think Missouri comes to mind, maybe. Iowa seems to have also some restrictions in place. I know Iowa is talking about restrictions being lifted. Their garnishment restriction, I think, also was set to expire today. And I saw something earlier indicating that Governor Richards, I believe, there will not be extending it. So it will be state by state, but I think that, as John pointed out, we'll also see county by county. In larger states and even the smaller ones, New Jersey, Massachusetts courts, I've got plenty of stuff up there that just we don't even know when we're going back to court. So things that we thought we were going to be doing in June, we're already planning that they're going to get kicked till September. That's the Boston area. And I think that when you get down the East Coast to where John and Stephanie are, things begin to change. I don't know why that is, but they're taking a different approach, and they may be doing it on a statewide basis. But you're going to have to talk to your collection council. It's really what you're going to have to do.
And I think, unfortunately, a lot of this, although it's a health issue, has become a political issue, depending on whether we're talking state or federal courts. So Texas, for example, never had a statewide shutdown order. Now the governor is actually prohibiting counties and cities for making the shutdown decisions, which has led to some interesting high-profile stories, like the woman who was held in contempt for defying a court order, and the attorney general publicly criticized the court for enforcing its order. The federal district court in Illinois, the presiding judge there has just issued her fourth amended order regarding COVID-19, not extending any more deadlines this time, but setting forth a variety of procedures to take into account the challenges created by the event, by the virus. And she just issued a really incredibly good video to the bar at large, talking about what efforts the district courts have been making in the Northern District of Illinois, and stating, as many of us expected, that as things start up, criminal trials are going to take precedence. Mike, I will tell you that actually is the thing that I've been worried about since this started, which is come the startup, speedy trial rights are going to get in the way of all of us civil attorneys. And while there are some places where the criminal dockets have continued to proceed pretty efficiently, Austin's federal court being one of them, that's not true everywhere. And those criminal cases are going to jump ahead of all the civil dockets. At least that's my expectation. I'm curious if anyone disagrees with me.
Already has. The judges I talked to, they got to do the criminal. So where we would have multiple conferences concerning a case, usually concerning a discovery issue, judges are saying, look, try to work it out, guys. Get back to me in another month. And just continuing that, because they have to focus on these. And they're trying to do it, at least here, New York metro area, up through Massachusetts. They're trying to do it remotely, even the criminal, to the extent they can. So the backlog is enormous.
Somebody disagreeing with Manny, that would be interesting. We did get a question in. Many state court systems during the pandemic are closed, and as such, have suspended deadlines during the time like this, like the statute of limitations. What kind of liability or pitfalls will this cause for debt collection attorneys and their clients? Michael, we haven't heard from you in a while. You want to weigh in?
I'm happy to weigh in on any issue you throw at me, Mike. You know, if in fact deadlines are told, things like statute of limitations, they just are put on hold, you should be in the same boat as you were before during the tolling period. So you just need to be very careful. Don't assume that your deadline's told until you actually have an order in that particular jurisdiction where that case would be brought, because you can, you know, rest assured that the other side will use it against you if you wait and it was not in fact told. So what told means is that basically the statute of limitations stops running. So I don't know if that answers your question, but you're really going to have to make sure you look at your specific account in that specific jurisdiction and whether or not it is on hold or not. Otherwise, you get yourself in a pickle.
Okay, excellent. Thank you very much. One state we haven't talked a lot about or really all about at all about today, but is worth spending some time on is California. Don, you want to talk about what's going on in the Golden State?
COVID related, yes. More broadly than that, no, not. But we've got a bill pending in California, this Assembly Bill 2501. And this bill is quite a pack full of fun things for mortgages and vehicles. So there would be mortgage forbearance and foreclosure stay. It would last during the period of the COVID emergency, plus for 6 months after. And kind of does some extraordinary things that all you have to do is ask for it, you shall receive forbearance. And that is really, really something that I haven't seen elsewhere. And then also motor vehicle loan forbearance. Ask and you shall receive, although the period may be somewhat less that you can have for forbearance. But you can't repossess if this bill were to pass, just like you couldn't foreclose if that bill were to pass. The bill is moving fairly fast. I know that this is a bill that RMAI is working on. David Reed, as many of you know, leads that up, and we've been very active in our opposition to this bill, as I suppose many others will be in the auto and housing, the mortgage industry. But it would be something extraordinary. There has been rumors that Los Angeles was contemplating a collection ban. Those were last month in April. We started to hear that. I know that Midland, Sonia Gibson was on top of that. We haven't heard much though about that this month. And we think that the Los Angeles mayor's office came to the conclusion that they did not have the authority to ban collections outright. So that is where we are on COVID related in California.
You keep saying COVID related.
Well, because there's always something else. You know, there's plenty. We could spend an entire webinar on California or Massachusetts. So I don't want you to think that's it. And again, these are just proposals. These are not laws that are enacted, but you should watch that one bill that I have up there, that AB 2501, because it is moving somewhat fast. But we're watching it.
Well, another thing.
Go ahead.
No, please, Don.
No, but we're watching it at RMAI. So if you're an RMAI member, you'll get an alert if we see anything happening there that we should caution you to be more careful than you already are.
Well, and I agree. California's always got a whole bunch of stuff we could spend, not just a webinar, probably a week just talking about it. But one other thing that in preparing for this, when I saw the note about California and licensing, I know New York, the bill, you know, died, and it may come back next year because there was a bill introduced, I think, by Governor Cuomo at the outset of the year wanting to implement collection agency licensing in New York. So I looked because I hadn't checked out California in a bit, which had a similar proposal introduced earlier this year, and it appears to still be working its way through the Senate, the California Senate. It's been amended. It's not dead yet. So, I had just kind of checked off in my head that in both states, we might not have to think about that until at least the new year, but maybe not in California. Another thing to perhaps keep our eyes on. I don't know if anybody else has been tracking that a little bit more closely than I have.
It's moving. That's another, again, when I prefaced COVID related, that's one that I didn't consider COVID related because that came pre-COVID, and that's something that RMAI is working on very much. David Reed and our lobbyist and our state legislative committee are very engaged on that bill.
The state senator who is sponsoring that legislation is now using COVID, though, as a reason to push the bill through. I have seen that.
It's Wachowski. We know, it's everything. What tray of good things will Wachowski deliver to the collection industry this session is usually how it goes.
Excellent. Well, thank you for that, Manny. You would wanted to talk about the impact of pre-COVID provisions on sort of post-COVID life. So I wanted to give you a few minutes to address that.
Thanks, Mike. Yeah, this is one of my concerns is that we've been so focused on all of the new and exciting toys that we get to play with in the COVID-19 world that it becomes easy to forget that all of those pre-COVID-19 rules are still in play. And some to be thinking about. Massachusetts. The federal district court blocked the emergency rules. It didn't block the existing provision of 940 Code of Massachusetts Regs section 7.04 that restricts you to initiating a communication to a telephone more than two times in a 7-day period. And the Attorney General's Consumer Protection Division has a great interest in ensuring that industry members comply with that provision. Similarly, and by the way, I don't want to forget to say this, Attorney General regulations apply to creditors and law firms specifically, so just keep that in mind. They have validation of debt provisions, and Massachusetts has its own very specific debt validation requirement. We have state like California where the entire FDCPA, with a few exceptions, has been engrafted into state law applied to creditors as well as collectors. So you've got a parallel state law provision, and multiple states have FDCPA-like provisions in their licensing and consumer protection laws. States like Maine and Colorado come to mind. You've got Colorado, where Section 559.72 would restrict creditors from communicating with people who are represented by counsel. We see a lot of litigation in the debt buying space fighting over whether the debt buyer did or did not know that the consumer had a lawyer. Provisions still in play. Texas's Debt Collection Act, which has a variety of specialized provisions, still in play. The Pennsylvania Fair Credit Extension Uniformity Act, its UTP-CPL, still in play. And so I think there is a real need to ensure that everyone's watching this, because here's what happens. The simple reality is, as I often say, everything we do in compliance is unibody construction. You can't touch something without affecting something else. And if the compliance teams and the marketing teams and the business generation teams aren't all communicating with one another and watching to be sure that new ideas to deal with the COVID-19 world comply with old requirements, there's going to be a lot of problems for the agencies that forget that. This is going to be critical that 360-degree review of every change comes into place. That as everyone's pushing, as businesses start up and people go back to work to get money in the door, all these new letters have to be reviewed with the same degree of care and the same careful, cautious analysis that would have gone on pre-COVID-19. There can't be a rush to get letters out and a rush to build new call campaigns and call scripts without taking into account everything we looked at before the virus hit.
Let me echo what Manny is saying there, because this is something that we have seen since 2017. There has been a marked increase in state activity. What was 2017? Well, it was the inauguration of Donald Trump. The RMAI has been working in at levels that we have not seen before then. More states are now seeking to regulate debt collection than we've ever seen before. And they're, what is key about what they're doing, and this is not something that we typically see, is that it used to be about data and documents, and it's going far beyond that now. They're addressing a creditor's ability to collect a debt. Remember, the FDCPA is conduct related. They're getting into the mechanics of it. What you can garnish, how you can garnish, how much you can garnish, when you have to file, what disclosures you have to give, what languages you have to give them in. And they're capturing creditors as well. This is something that we're seeing in Massachusetts. We're seeing it in New York. New York, very close last year to extinguishing delinquent debt outright, gone, wiped away. And Massachusetts was trying to do the same. Other states are moving in this direction. Our home state, New Jersey, and I don't know if we're gonna have time talking about New Jersey, but New Jersey has been quiet for decades on this issue, and suddenly is coming up with oodles of legislation addressing collection. So what has COVID-19 done? It's made states look at something that they haven't looked at, and states that haven't looked at in a long time are now looking at it. And what they realize is also is that unlike other federal laws, the FDCPA doesn't preempt. It actually says you can go ahead and regulate if it's more restrictive. And so FDCPA and federal regulation will not help you here. And I can tell you now that you talk to David Reed, I don't think the man sleeps. Because it's every day we're getting new hits on new, and it's just not states either. We can talk about New York City in a moment. Municipalities are also getting into the act. So there's a lot going on. It's not going to end. And my prediction is it's going to accelerate. We're going to see more in 2021, and it's going to be more burdensome. And it's not just going to be about conduct. It's going to be about mechanics.
Don Maurice, the happy good news guy.
Hey, you know,
no, but Don makes a really good point, because even just during this call, I've had a bunch of things pop into my inbox about legislation in different states that's introduced, that's been amended, that's evolving. And there's a lot of it. And it's as if, to your point, Don, regardless of what does or does not happen in Washington and the stimulus bills that we see proposed there and Maxine and everything that's going on, some of the states are taking that very seriously. And I said, yeah, I actually do think the FDCPA should apply to creditors, at least during this state of emergency. So I'm going to put some stuff out there. Maybe these are people that are up for reelection. I mean, who knows? I don't follow every state legislator, but there is a lot of noise around this, and I don't think that's going to die down anytime soon, including after the pandemic passes or is behind us and we're not in a state of emergency. People are making big statements. Politicians are taking big positions. Doesn't mean it'll all come to fruition, but I also don't see them just, you know what, that was fun then. We'll stop for now.
Well, and just to add one more facet to this, although Don's absolutely right, 15 U.S.C. 1692N says that the FDCPA doesn't preempt state laws that are more restrictive. I'm actually defending a class action in Massachusetts in which the plaintiff argues that the defendant's strict compliance with notice requirements of state law violates the FDCPA. And as states enact notice provisions, just watch for that one, with the plaintiff's bar saying, yeah, well, it's not more restrictive, it's less restrictive because it confuses consumers, and so we're going to sue you for doing what state law requires. And if you're a business owner, just keep in mind, you can't settle that case because you don't have an exit plan. If you settle the federal lawsuit, you can't change your behavior, so the next day you're either starting to build up the next class or you change your behavior and build up the regulatory action by the state. We figure we're going to the First Circuit on that one. We're in the middle of fighting... I'm actually having to fight to uphold the legitimacy of the Massachusetts AG Reagan question to protect my client from the FDCPA class action.
We've only got a couple of minutes left. We have one question in the chat box. I'm gonna, if you have the chat box open, panel, you can follow along because there's a lot to unpack here. But let me read it. You work from home in a state that does not require a license or regulation for branch office. You do not have a branch office. The state has lifted all stay-at-home restrictions, thus allowing you the ability to return to the office. But you still have work-from-home staff who are calling into states that have a temporary waiver in place for license and branch regulations or registrations. Can the other states' regulators fine you because you're still allowing staff to work from home? Anyone want to?
Do you have a license in those states? If you have a license in those states and they say you have to license a branch office, they probably can fine you. And by the way, they probably can revoke or suspend your license if you violate their rules. When you choose to take a license from a regulator, you give them the power to fine you or revoke your license. And so you've got to play by their rules. If you're talking about a state that itself has no work from home prohibition, no big deal. But the question implies, can I violate the work from home restriction of a state that I'm going to call into? And I have to assume you complied with the licensing requirement of that state. Why would they not be able to fine you? Stephanie, you disagree with me?
I would not be so brave as to be the one person to disagree with you per our comment earlier, but I actually totally agree. States have a history of sanctioning you if you have a license for behavior elsewhere, involving other states, involving the CFPB. What I was contemplating, Manny, is will they? And the answer is some might. I don't want to assume anybody will act reasonable and actually recognize the circumstances that are confronting all of us in the industry. So I was wondering if there's any, I'm wondering if there's any utility in that kind of circumstance to reaching out, perhaps on a no-names basis, to the regulator you're concerned about. They're probably in a state that is colored blue. And trying to get a reaction in advance or thoughts or just any sort of guidance, because I think what you're saying could happen is absolutely right on. And in fact, there's a precedent for that happening in the past outside of the COVID-19 world in different circumstances. When you do something wrong here, so-and-so gets mad over there and your license is sanctioned or conditioned or revoked as a result.
Excellent. Nobody else wants to weigh in? Enough said. All right. Well, we have run out of time, but I'm not going to let everybody off the hook that easily. What I'd like to do is go around the panel one last time and give each of you a chance to share your parting words of wisdom, your key takeaways, your foreboding and foreshadowing of all the difficult times that are to come. In terms of increased regulation and increased lawsuits and how the industry is going to weather that or just a great recipe if you want to share that instead. But we'll go around the panel and give everybody a chance to share some takeaways. John Bedard, we'll start with you.
Look, it's not all doom and gloom. I mean, we have seen things that have affected this industry and that have been a lot more impactful than what's happening now. We're going to roll with it. We're going to get good advice from your trusted advisors, all right? And we're going to do the right thing when our advisors tell us what the rules are. The rules of the road are changing in many places, and we have to keep our eyes on the road. So long as we keep our eyes on the road and we keep doing what we're doing, our industry is going to get through this. I think it's going to be okay. It might look a little bit different at the end of the road than it does now. It most certainly probably will. I think a lot of things are going to improve about how this industry operates in the marketplace when things get back to a different kind of normal now. We're using technology in ways we've never used it before. We are using remote workforces and different infrastructure in ways we've never used it before. This situation is forcing the industry to ask themselves why they do the things they do and whether or not there's a better way. And the answer is there may very well be a better way for many of the things that we do now. And so I remain very hopeful that although we're going through difficulty right now, that we are going to come out of this, and we're actually going to come out of it a bit better and a bit stronger, more efficient, and better off for it, I think. Those are my rose-colored glasses there.
Well said, John. Thank you. Don, Maurice.
Well, to say what I said before, be careful of the states. The focus has been on the rules and the proposed regulations that we have seen under the FDCPA. I would be wary of the states. They're hard right now pressed to do anything because they too have to stay at home. And so many of them are having legislative sessions remotely. But I think that when we see activity after this list lifts, it's going to be at the state level. Be active. I want to point out the New Jersey Creditors Bar. It was very active in defeating a very nasty bill in New Jersey. And they did it at the last minute. So be active with your state units. Look to engage lobbyists where you can. We're in associations like RMAI that are active at the state level. We'll be remembered for what our individual companies and for what our associations did in response to this. And so keep that in mind as it continues. I don't think it's over yet. Mike tells me I still can't go back to my office in New Jersey. So for me and for many, it is not over. And I hope it doesn't come back. But continue to keep a watchful eye on what your state legislators are doing.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Stephanie?
So congratulations on the CFPB recently reporting that debt collection-related complaints are no longer in first place, but note that credit reporting concerns are. I think going forward, we really, the extent that anybody in the, on this call is furnishing, we're going to see big uptick in FCRA claims relating to state laws that are prohibiting adverse reporting as a result of accommodations because of understandings or misunderstandings about the CARES Act and what it did and did not require and what it does and does not require. Just going to be an area for, plaintiffs' lawyers to have a real field day in the future. And there isn't actually a lot of guidance or rules to that road, to John's point, a lot of gray areas. So hard to know what rules to comply with.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Manny?
I'd probably make just three simple points. One, Will Rogers said, if you find yourself in a hole, stop digging. And I think that's an important rule to always remember, especially as you're dealing with these issues. Number two, when someone tells you that it's not possible to solve a problem, stop and ask why. I heard an awful lot of we can'ts during the first few weeks that turned out to be dead wrong. And third, be good creative fiction writers. Spin the scenarios that might happen in a second wave or an infected employee or cluster of employees and figure out what you're going to do. Play out the scenarios and be sure that your business continuation plans really are effective and that you don't perpetuate the mistake we made before of planning for the wrong disaster.
Excellent. Thank you. Michael Clutho.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. And Mike does a wonderful job of this type of education for us, and his publications are wonderful as well as keeping us up on top of this. I did want to let everyone know that I oftentimes like to look at what our opposition is doing, what they're putting out there, because that's kind of their playbook, their roadmap as to how they're going to make claims against us. And so there's the National Consumer Law Center that's out there. And if you I'll say this a couple of times, so you can write it down, but if you're trying to keep on top of what's happening, what the changes are, what the roadblocks are, the landmines, whatever your adage, the National Consumer Law Center is doing a really good job of outlining all the things that are protecting the consumers, the things that we need to make sure that we keep in mind, like garnishments getting shut down, you know, things like that. And it's if you Google major consumer protections announced in response to COVID-19, major consumer protections announced in response to COVID-19, it will give you just a whole laundry list of just clicking on, and you can state limits on collection lawsuits, post-judgment remedies, debt collection, repossession, student loan foreclosures, all the sorts of things, evictions, the types of things that you folks need to know when you're in the trenches. So I just throw that out there for what it's worth.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. Thank you for the kind words, but I'm only able to do what I do because people like you keep saying yes when I ask for your help and your insight. So panel, thank you very much. John, Don, Stephanie, Manny, Michael, this was awesome. Really appreciate you taking the time to walk us through what is a very tricky and shifting minefield.
All right. Thanks
for having us, Mike.
My pleasure.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. Thanks for your participation. One more webinar tomorrow, dissecting the HEROES Act and what else Congress is doing to regulate debt collection, because we talked about the states today. Let's talk about what the federal government's doing tomorrow. So hope you come back for that. Until then, stay safe, and we'll talk to everybody soon. Take care.
Thank you, Mike. Bye-bye.